how is this happening? Where the hell are the people who are going to come in and say enough?
The flag was hoisted before the world.
What does it mean to fight back? We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
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 With Chai Davidai.
So here I am with Deborah Messing.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here.
I'm thrilled.
And I have to say, I know like kids call this being a fanboy, you know, like, and I told you, like, I loved you from your very first show that was prematurely canceled, and then obviously Will and Grace and everything. And then all of a sudden you show up on my radar, and not as an actress, not as a famous, glamorous, beautiful person, but as a Jew.
Yeah.
So I start with a question that with everyone I start. Deborah, what kind of a Jew are you?
Oh, I'm an angry Jew right now.
An angry Jew?
What
are you angry about?
I'm angry about the double standard, about the hypocrisy, about the cowardice, about the propaganda, about the legitimization, all of it. But I know you didn't. That's not what you were expecting. So I would say.
No, no, no. That is. So one thing you should know about this this show, this podcast, is there are no expectations. When I started this, the whole idea was this. There are so many amazing people doing amazing work fighting for Jewish civil rights. I want to meet each and every one of them. And I want the world to meet them like I do.
Okay.
No expectations, no rules, no nothing. So
okay. Yeah.
It's surprising me that you would say that because you don't look angry.
You don't see me in my apartment when okay. I'm watching the news or I'm reading, you know, the comments in my social media feed. I get very angry, but I also have learned over the years what that does to me internally. Mm. And it causes me to be ill. And so I have been very intentional about trying to keep my anger a step away from me. But I feel no pressure or need to temper it. I think it's warranted. I'm sure a lot of the anger that I have comes from deep, deep sadness. I've been an activist my whole adult life and have fought on the side of the marginalized unconditionally. And then to find out on October 8th that all of these allies were not real allies. And I felt so bereft. I feel like this has been a very long mourning period. I can't say that I have come to terms with it.
I don't know if you can come to terms with it. I mean, the words you use is angry, sad, abandoned, bereft. Like, that takes a lifetime to come to terms with it. And I think a lot of Jewish people are, you know, almost feeling guilty that they haven't moved on, that they haven't come to terms with it. But why should we?
I think that, you know, we're fighters. And I guess I've assumed that sort of living with the sadness and everything that's associated with that would somehow be an obstacle to my activism. But it hasn't. It hasn't been.
Have you always been an angry Jew?
No. No.
If I ask you, what kind of a Jew are you 2, 3, 4 years ago?
Before Charlottesville. Charlottesville was the thing that I think.
The march in Charlottesville, Jews will not replace us, the tiki
yes,
torches.
Yes, and very, very fine people on both sides.
Yeah, 2017,
mm-hmm.
Right?
That was, you know, when everything exploded for me. Prior to that, I felt like I was a proud Jew. I felt like I had a responsibility as a Jew, more of a secular Jew, but enjoyed Passover and would go to temple on the high holidays. It's interesting because I grew up Reform, but I was one of three Jews in my entire school system.
Hmm. And where was this? Where did you?
Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. And when I was in second grade, we were lining up for gym class, and a little boy turned to me and said, "Get to the back of the line, Kike." And I didn't know what it meant, but Whoa. The teacher did. And the teacher sent the kid to the principal's office, and everyone in the class looked at me like, "What did you do?"
Say that again. That's not what I was expecting you'd say. So
surprise.
So how old? Do you remember how old you were?
Second grade.
Second grade, like 8 years old. So yeah. Like my son.
Yeah.
And you get called a kike. The kid, as they should, gets called to the principal's office. Probably, mm-hmm. probably didn't know what they were saying. You know, give him like some education and some consequences. And all the other kids are looking to blame
me.
You.
And it was the first instance of victim blaming that I have ever experienced. But it was so profoundly confusing for me that all I knew in my cells was that it would be safer for me if the kid just came back and we all forgot about it and we didn't talk about it and we were just...
I think that's a feeling that's shared from many, many Jews even right now.
Yeah, yes. And I have, you know, we had a swastika painted on my grandfather's car on Halloween. We had, you know, big globe balls at the end of our driveway that were smashed with a bat on a regular basis. My father replaced them. Then it was our mailbox. Then it was our garbage cans. And I knew at a very young age that people didn't like us. And
what did your parents tell you?
Well, that's the interesting thing, is that my parents, my father was vice president of Jewish Federation. My mother was president of the National Board of Women's, you know, Business and Professional. My father was president of the temple that we went to.
So to be, you're too nice, so I'll be blunt. They were fucking fighters.
They were fighters, yeah. Yes. They were, you know, and they were Zionists. They went to Israel, you know, at least six times in my childhood. And every time I would say, "I'm going to go," they're like, "It's not quite safe enough right now." And mm-hmm. as a Jewish parent would.
So what do Jewish parents who, on the one hand, are, you know, up for the fight, that's what they dedicate a big chunk of their life to, but on the other hand, want to protect their daughter?
You know, they...
How did they do that?
They sat me down. They explained to me what a kike was. They educated me thoroughly on the Holocaust. They made it very clear that the Jews have been persecuted for thousands of years, not for anything that they've done, or it's just because of who they are, and it doesn't make sense. But we're a proud people, and we deserve to be here and to be celebrated and respected. And it's incumbent on us to make sure that no one forgets the Holocaust. I mean, my parents talk to me about the Holocaust all the time. You know, my dad would say, "Okay, you need to have at least three children to replenish the people lost in the Holocaust."
That, wow.
Yeah. I mean, those were the conversations. So I said, "Can we have a Christmas tree?" You know, just to fit in, because I just felt so alone all the time. And they were like, "Absolutely not." I didn't realize, I went to Brandeis University for college, which is lovingly called Jew You.
It was named after Louis Brandeis, the first Jewish Supreme Court justice.
Yes.
You know, no university should be called Jew You or any other minority slur,
yes.
But at the same time, it has a rich Jewish history.
And at the time that I was there, the percentage of the Jewish population within the student body was very high. And that was sort of required by my parents because of my upbringing. They're like, you need to go someplace where you are represented and you feel like you're part of a community. And when I got there, I realized that I had never in my entire life felt safe until I was on that campus. And that was a really profound thing to recognize. I think I became an activist for the LGBTQ community and, global ambassador going to Africa, testifying in front of, Congress. I didn't realize it at the time, but I was too scared to be an activist for the Jews.
So let's get to that. But before we get to that, I do want to talk about your previous activism experience and ongoing. I'm not saying
okay,
you, because
yeah.
I know you keep doing the stuff that you started. You didn't switch to something else. You've added.
Yeah.
And the reason I want to delve a little bit into that is because a lot of people right now are Jews and non-Jews want to fight for Jewish civil rights. They want to fight back. They want to be active, but we're playing catch up because it started for many of us in the past few months. Some people started in 2021, in the previous war.
Yep.
You've been doing this in other topics for a while. So can you talk a little bit about that?
I think because I was on Will and Grace, and at the time it was so provocative and...
I should tell you something about Will and Grace, how incredible that was. So growing up in Israel, and I'm a heterosexual guy, and yet seeing a show where there are two lead homosexual men mm-hmm. was so empowering for me, not so much because of their sexual preference on the show, but because it was two other ways to be a man that is not what I saw in my somewhat suburban, somewhat urban experience outside of Tel Aviv. It was for me a lot. It's like you can be a masculine man, but not a toxic man.
Yes.
And I think people don't talk about that aspect of Will and Grace and how much it was important, not just for the LGBTQ community, but for men who are different or felt different.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. That's never been articulated to me before. So thank you for that.
And the show has been credited with being part of creating a real shift in attitudes in the U.S.
Yes, and it's the proudest thing, in my life that I was a part of it. Gay marriage, we were part of that campaign. And I think because we were dealing with anti-gay matters all the time and trying to make jokes about them, I think that it sort of closed the aperture and made me realize, oh, I haven't been an ally to this community, even though I've been in the theater my whole life, and I have gay and lesbian friends, but I've never been an activist for them. And it was a wake-up call for me. So I started doing things on the side and seeing progress. And so I thought, okay, you know what? It's when George Floyd happened, I was like, okay, let's go. Let's go. And marched and marched and marched and screamed and posted and it was very important to me that it was clear that I was an ally to that community. And then it was anti-Asian hate, and that I just, it was like, okay, who is being oppressed right now? whose civil rights and human rights are being tested, diminished, attacked. And I felt like I have to step in.
But why? I mean,
I think being Jewish was part of it.
But let me show you the flip of it, which is you could have said, look, I was part of this show. This show already had an effect. It's time for other people to step up. You know, you are super busy. Mm-hmm. You know, why you?
I think it's a responsibility for every human being to participate in making the world better, in making us a more civilized society. Mm-hmm. I mean, you asked me why you, the first thing that I thought was, why not me? Mm. You know, and
why not each and every one of us?
Exactly. And I think my childhood is being an other, my, you know, I felt a kinship to all of these people, who were othered, and, especially the Black community because of the civil rights era. And maybe part of it was about this exact moment. You know, I had never seen or experienced any solidarity with, you know, yeah, being a Jewish person. And I think entering the community of activists, I felt included in a much, much larger, part of society.
So you get the inclusion. And I think that's something that people don't really talk about a lot. How, yes, speaking up, fighting takes a toll on you, but it's also so immensely gratifying,
yes,
and fulfilling. And you get this inclusion, and yet then October 7th happens. Mm. Then October 8th happens in New York City, and then the exclusion comes. How do you then become the activist that we know and cherish that you are now, which is not just an activist for civil rights, but also an activist for Jewish civil rights?
I think that I was so shattered on October 8th, seeing the celebrations in the street. I honestly thought that it was just going to be a small percentage of the population and that it would dissipate after a couple of days. Mm-hmm. And as it expanded and proliferated, I just remember thinking, okay, you know what? You have to acknowledge the fact that you have been living an illusion your entire adult life. They hate us. They've always hated us. And they always will hate us.
Who's they?
Everyone who has a strain of exclusion, division, racism. And that was very enervating for me. It was like, okay, you know what? I can't depend on anybody except my people. It's a new lesson. I learned it at 55 years old. But thank you, universe, for teaching it to me, because now I know where to look and who to fall back on. And I realized I looked around and I didn't have a Jewish community. Mm. You know, most of my friends were not Jewish. And after realizing that most of my friends were silent, I think I experienced sort of an identity crisis. And then I just thought, okay, you know what? This is unacceptable. This is bullshit. We've been here before. They're telling us what they're going to do. They are telling the world that they want to execute every last one of us. And, you know, they're choosing to not care about that. But we know what happens if we stay silent. Yeah. And so then it was just, you know, follow the leaders. Really, I was like, how do I do this? I've never been a an activist for the Jews before. And so it was seeing you on social media and seeing you speaking out and, you know, being asked to speak and feeling like, I was panicked when I had to speak in Washington, D.C. I was like, this isn't what I do.
You did not look panicked. And I have to say, it's so interesting that you say that, because I have been looking at other people that are speaking up. I've been looking at you and Mandana and, people that I've had here on the show. And I feel like I have no idea what I'm doing. And then seeing like, okay, just they seem to know what they're doing. Follow them. Things will fall in place.
It's just, we inspire each other. We give each other strength and courage to speak out. I would look at you and say, oh, okay, here's a man who has moral clarity. He knows what's right and wrong. And he knows what's happening in his community on that campus. And he is just speaking truth to power. And I was like, you know what? You can't lose if you speak what you know. If you speak from your experience, what you know, what you've seen, there's always power in that. And storytelling, I'm an actor, so obviously I have a bias where I think storytelling is remarkably powerful. And I've really seen that in the last 8 months, is seeing, hearing the stories about the survivors from Nova, hearing the stories from, the people who were picking up body parts, and it made it so clear and so much harder to say, that's not true, that did not happen. And so I feel like I've just been trying to take it one day at a time. Like, I never thought that we would be here 8 months later. I never thought.
Yeah, me neither.
So I don't know where this is going. I don't know when this is going to end.
I don't think it will ever end. In fact, if we do our job right, we will make sure that this stays in the public consciousness for the rest of our lives. I don't think that people that are engaged in the LGBTQ fight for equal rights, in the anti-racism movements, I'm not speaking about those that are doing it for virtue signaling and just for,
right.
But I'm talking about the real people. Like, that's a job for life. And it's a job that they didn't ask for, but it's a job for life. And
I agree. I agree with you. I believe that, the lights have been turned on for us.
And by the way, I think a lot of people will hear that and be scared. I don't want to fight for Jewish civil rights if it's for life. And I actually see it. Yes, it is scary. It is confusing. But at the same time, it gives me a little bit of comfort knowing that 30 years from now, I don't know what I'll be doing for a job. I don't know what my hobbies will be. I don't know what my politics will be. I do know where my values will be. Mm-hmm. And I do know what I will be standing for. And I'll be standing up for Jewish civil rights.
I mean, I think it's something to celebrate. Yeah. Because up until now, most of us have been too scared to speak up, even if we haven't acknowledged it to ourselves. Thinking like, look at all the inclusion, look at all the awareness about pronouns, and, we're fine. We're respected. We don't need to worry about that anymore. And now it's like, no, hello, it never stopped. And this is something that you're always going to have to do, is to champion your own people. And I feel ready for that. The thing that I don't know and that scares me is the what's happening in the streets everywhere. You know, the vitriol, the violent rhetoric, you know, it is there's so much rage behind it. And I don't feel equipped at this point to dismantle that.
Yeah. How do you deal with the personal hate that you are receiving? There's a picture of you, and maybe you can talk a little bit about that initiative, of you holding a sign, and it's basically a hateful comment that you got on social media, and it just says a number, and that number is 6,000,001. There's something in your look, in your eyes, in that picture of it, you are both crushed, but also defiant.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do it? How do you deal? I'm assuming you get a lot of this.
Yeah, I do. And at first I was trying to have dialogues. Like I you know, I would respond not in an inflammatory way. You know, I would address whatever accusations that they were saying, that, you know, and I would try to use facts to dismantle the foundation of what they were, of where they were coming from. And it clearly, it was a fool's mission. And once I realized it was a fool's mission, then I just started deleting. When I would see something that wouldn't move the conversation forward and was a distraction as far as I was concerned, I would delete it. And then I started blocking people. And, you know, at one point it got really, really bad. And I had people telling me to stop all comments, make it so that no one could comment on my posts. And I did for like a day. And then I thought, no, you know, people have to see the hatred. You know, there's you know, a back and forth that's happening in my comments from both sides. And it's educational to read through them. And I didn't want to whitewash it.
Mm.
Is really what it came down to.
Yeah, that's a very interesting take on, you know, sometimes activism is just shedding light on reality. And reality right now is happening at the comment section. It doesn't end there. That's where people get their ideas and their hatred and rage grows, and then it goes out to the streets, into the subways, into the protests, into college campuses. But exposing the reality, even on the comment section, is already part of saying, look at what the world is right now.
Yeah. And, you know, I just felt like, okay, this is something that I can do. This is something that I could use my platform for. This is my priority. You know, I got to tell you, when I saw what was happening on campus at Columbia, it broke me. Like, over the whole 8 months, it wasn't until I started seeing what was happening on the campuses.
Why specifically the campuses?
I think because for so long, you know, education, I've been taught, is everything. You know, my whole life, it's like you just keep going on school. You know, you never stop learning. And so I always had, you know, a elevated respect for professors, for people who in academia, and have always assumed that they know better. They know more.
The as someone who lives and breathes with these professors, I can tell you that they also believe that they know better. That's been part of my concern, and it's something that's been happening for a while. I've been always been telling people, like, just because we're professors at Columbia doesn't make us smarter. It makes us better paid.
The fact that it is at the most elite schools where it is, you know, it is supposed to be, you know, this utopian place for the great thinkers of the future to grow, and to think that they are, you know, using their body to block you from entering, walking across campus. I'm just like, how is this happening? How, you know, I had no idea that, you know, that there were professors that were espousing hate, and the administration knew about it and did nothing about it.
Yeah. For decades.
And I, you know, and the whole, I'm still trying to parse out the First Amendment right and the excuse that using that excuse at every turn to not take action. The fact that the encampment was up, you know, it had been up already a week, and, you know, this kid was surrounded, and, you know, a janitor was held hostage in a building, and I'm like, where the hell are the people who are going to come in and say enough? Rules were broken. And I think that, you know, I've always been a good girl. I've always, you know, I follow rules. And to see them blatantly, joyfully broken and almost mockingly broken, knowing that no one was going to do anything about it.
You know, when back in around February, I was working with SSI, Students Supporting Israel, to have a rally on campus. And the one thing I told them is, we are going to follow each and every rule until, like, the last digit, you know, anything.
Yes.
If they tell us you can't stand here, we take five steps back. If they tell us you have to finish by 1:30, we're 1:20, we're out. And the reason why I wanted that to be is to show the double standard, that we follow all the rules and that's how we fight. And yet the other side has absolutely no respect for the rules because there's no consequences for them.
And it didn't matter. It didn't, it wasn't acknowledged, like, that the message did not get through.
No. I want to ask you something that I assume you've been, if not asked a lot about, then I'm sure thought a lot about. Where's Hollywood? Where are the non-Jews and where are the Jews that... I am sure in your other activism, not only were happy to join, but in many cases probably called you, like, where can I do this? Where can I get a photo op with this charity, with that thing?
Yeah.
Where are they?
They are MIA. And I'm embarrassed. The idea that, like, literally Hollywood was built and created by Jews. Every studio was a Jewish person who had come over, and they weren't allowed to be a teacher. They weren't allowed to be a lawyer. They weren't allowed to be anything. And so they're like, all right, we're going to create our own industry. We'll make entertainment an industry. The whole thing was built by Jews. And, you know, it is very populated by Jewish people. And so I thought, oh, of course, those people, especially the people in power, are going to step up and be leaders. And, I mean, I'm like, where's Adam Sandler? You know, Jonah Hill, actors, comedians, who have built their fortune and their fame on playing Jewish characters. And yet now we are literally being beaten in the streets and nothing. And I feel like it's a disgrace. Let me tell you something. Yeah. As soon as it happened, a group of us got together on a WhatsApp, and we were like, okay, we've got to do something. And the first thing we did was we put together a letter to the president, and all it said was, please, please do everything you possibly can to bring all of the hostages home. Thank you. And we sent it out to Hollywood. You would not believe the number of people who refused to sign it. And I felt my chest explode.
Why did they refuse? And I assume there are different reasons, but...
Well, one very, very famous journalist responded to that request with, can you prove the babies were decapitated?
So if they were only killed but not decapitated, that's okay?
It's so horrifying. It's like, these are hostages. It has nothing. They're from 33 countries. We are making this as narrow as possible because we understand that this is a powder keg. And let's make it narrow so that literally the whole world can come together, at least for this, and pressure the global community to band together to get these hostages home. And when all of these, you know, all of these peers said no, most of the reasoning was, if I sign this and I am supportive of the hostages, that means I'm against Palestinians.
Is there anything in the letter that suggested that?
We never used the word Palestinian. We never used the word Israel. So that was the first one, and that was the key, you know, that moment where I was like, okay, this is you know, morally bankrupt, and the cowardice is so stunning to me. And then the next thing we tried, we put together a bunch of Broadway singers, and we did bring them home. It's beautiful.
It's a beautiful song.
And then the next one was, when all the evidence came out about the sexual violence, we did a letter that said, we are against sexual violence as a tool of war. And
sounds provocative and controversial.
They wouldn't sign it.
What? So you've been in entertainment for how long?
30 years.
You know many of these people. They are your friends. You've worked with many of these people.
Yes.
I can't put myself in their position because I just don't know. You have a better sense. Like, what goes on through the mind? And I'm not talking about Bella Hadid or Mark Ruffalo.
Right, right.
I'm talking about just either the Jewish individuals that you mentioned and some others that have made a career out of being Jewish. But then also the non-Jews that are just, I assume, very decent people.
Yeah.
What goes in their mind when they say, I'm unable to sign a letter for the release of hostages or a letter condemning sexual violence?
I honestly just think it's a deep-seated fear that they will be canceled, that showing any empathy toward the Jewish people, toward the Israeli people, was so provocative that it could lead to the collapse of their career and therefore their bank account.
Have you been canceled?
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, I know that I've lost jobs because, you know, they're like, she's just, you know, she's just too out there. You know, she's identified with that now.
How much do you think that has to do with the fact that you're also a woman?
You know, I haven't thought about that. I don't know. But yet I get calls from my agents and from my lawyer, and they say, we just want you to know that we are being deluged with calls from within our industry saying, please tell her thank you. And so immediately that made me feel relief, you know, but then I was like, wait a minute. If it's that meaningful to you that you pick up the phone to say thank you, what are you doing? What are you doing? And I, you know, it's all about power and money.
You know, I've had a very similar experience in academia, and I've been open about the fact that ever since I've started speaking up, almost the entire Columbia Business School, and especially my immediate department, my division, have completely shunned me out of their life. I now know what it's like. I don't care about cancel culture. I now know what it's like to be socially canceled. One person out of a department of 30 people reached out when I was barred from entry. And I've gotten accustomed to it. And yet, a couple of weeks ago, I was at an academic conference. My first academic conference is October, and I was very, very scared because I didn't know what people would say, what people think about me. And the one response that I kept getting is from professors and postdocs and PhD students coming up to me and say, thank you so much.
Oh, thank
I agree
God.
With you. I am with you. And I had the same experience like you. I was like, this is great. I am relieved. And then when that good feeling went away, I was left with, so
why are you
so
the only one
lonely in this fight for 8 months? Like, I could have used you and still need you.
Why do you think that people who feel like grateful to you about for speaking out, these professors, many of whom have tenure, and so there are, literally can be no repercussion. Why do you think that they keep silent?
There are many different reasons, but I think, and this is the difference between Hollywood and academia, professors are one of the most risk-averse groups in society. These are people that have talents and skills, and yet they choose to take the path of least resistance. They work hard for 6 years, then they get tenure, and they're done, they're good for life. They don't like to take risks. They like to talk about how it's important to show leadership, but they are not leaders. They like to talk about how it's important to be inclusive, but they're not inclusive. Hollywood is all about people who's decided, I am going to take a risk for something I believe in. Mm-hmm. It's people that have said, I am going to upend my entire life, move to Hollywood, move to New York for Broadway, and really put myself out there. So I would expect that for people that have done that and know what it feels like, and also have seen that, you know, you get shouted down and then you get up again, you know, and it's not like no one's had a 40-year career with just hits. So I would assume that in Hollywood you'd get way more, and it's funny to call it risk-taking, because I don't see it as risk-taking to say anti-Semitism is bad, or the hostages should be released, or sexual violence is never okay. That's not, for me, that's not a risk. The fact that it is a risk is already a problem, but...
Exactly.
Yeah. So you say you have paid some price.
I was being considered for, you know, a commercial endorsement, you know, so I would be the face of a product. And
that's
so
nice
I was
face.
like, I was like, I understand. And I'm fine with it. Mm-hmm. I'm fine with it. You know, I've been offered a couple of movies. None of them really interested me. I think it's because I'm so all in, and so I'm just not being inspired in the same way as I used to be. But I'm producing a documentary, and I've been developing a TV show on the side, and you know, so I'm still very much in my industry. What I will never know is if there is a great movie that they're casting and it's between me and someone else, and you know, the producer of the movie, the director of the movie, the casting director, if they happen to be, you know, anti-Israel, would they then be like, no, let's go with this one? I assume that will happen.
If it hasn't happened
already.
If it hasn't, yes.
And, you know, I'm okay with it. I'm like, if you can't stand up and say that anti-Semitism is wrong, that sexual violence as a tool of war is wrong, I don't want to be in business with you.
Yeah, I would take that a step further and say, I don't want my name to be associated with your name.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is that the silence is, you know, a protective mechanism for them as well. Mm-hmm. They can't be, you know, pinned down. And the whole thing about, oh, I don't want to take sides, that's silly. It's stupid. I do think that there is a percentage of people out there who have been silent who feel uneducated about the history of Israel and the history of the conflict. And so they fear that if they come out in support of Israel, that someone will start to push back and that they won't have the facts ready to be able to have a dialogue. And so I do think that is the case with a lot of people. They feel like they're going to say the wrong things.
I can definitely feel, I feel a lot of empathy for them. I try not to judge, but my
view.
Oh,
I judge.
Well, that's why I have you here. It's completely understandable to be uneducated. It's not understandable and not even acceptable to know you're uneducated, to know that this is an important topic, and yet choose to remain uneducated.
Yes.
So I want to talk about Israel.
Okay.
Because nothing in your upbringing, you've mentioned that your parents went to Israel a lot, but they were mm-hmm. Zionists, but nothing in your upbringing happened in Israel.
No.
Everything was here in the U.S. And yet, there's a video of you that I saw with Noah Tishbe from around December, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's in the airport in Israel.
It was in the lobby of a hotel.
Oh, it was a lobby of a hotel. And you're tearing up. And you're about to leave Israel and you say, I don't want to leave.
Yeah.
Why does Israel loom so large in who you are, and in many ways in who we Jews, not just in Israel, but outside of Israel?
When I was growing up, my mother spoke constantly about the importance of Israel and it being the Jewish homeland and it being the one safe place in the world where Jews can go, and that it was vitally important that we always support Israel and, you know, and make sure that America always supports Israel. It was always something that was over there for me. And when I went there, and it was the first time.
It was your first time?
Yeah. I had never been to Israel.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
Your introduction to Israel was December 2023.
Yeah. And it was going, walking through the kibbutzim and meeting with the survivors and the hostage families and the IDF, you know, amputees in the hospitals. That was my introduction. And I went into Gaza and I went into the tunnel with the IDF. I mean, it was a very, very profound trip. And I think the thing that I didn't expect was to feel like I was home.
Because in a way, if your first time, you're 55. You
55,
said?
Yeah.
You don't show up at home for the first
at
time.
55.
You're 55. So.
And you know, and to me, I think, you know, those Jews who are really attached to Israel, you know, who go on birthright and who, you know, do abroad, they choose to go to Israel, and I'm like, I respect all that, but that's just not me. And yet there I was, and I was walking through Tel Aviv, and I realized that I did not see one hostage poster ripped down. I live in New York City. I went to Times Square and I put them up all over the place, and they were all ripped down. And everywhere you go, you see, you know, it's so unconscionable. And to be walking through and realizing, you know, that a rocket could come at any time, but no one is going to come and pull down that, you know, that I am safe here, that I'm understood here, I'm seen here, I'm validated, I'm celebrated. It was a first for me. And I understood why Jews want to be in Israel, the importance of Israel. I mean, obviously it's in the Bible, it's in the Quran, it's in the, you know, Israel being the homeland of the Jews in Judea, it is, you can't be a Jew without having a connection to Israel.
Yet some Jews would say yes. I mean, and some very prominent Jews, people that have made like their careers about Jews, being Jews, like Ilana Glazer,
yeah,
Cynthia Nixon. They would tell you, well, I am Jewish. Israel plays no part. I would actually argue that Israel plays a huge part in their life. That's why they are so opposed to everything and are so anti-Zionist.
Can you explain that?
There are many, many countries that play no part in my life.
Yeah.
And I don't give them a second thought.
Right.
They don't define what I do. They don't determine my actions, my behaviors. When everything Ilana Glazer and Cynthia Nixon can talk about is Israel, that means that Israel plays a huge part. It's either guilt, it's either virtue signaling, it's either pick me, I'm the good kind of Jew. But it clearly plays a huge role.
I've yet to see anyone of their ilk respond to the question, where were you with Sudan, with Syria, with Afghanistan? We can list all of the countries where there have been horrible genocides and children have been stolen, Boko Haram. I mean, there are so many examples, and the numbers are so just, you can't even believe it. You can't believe how many people were killed. 500,000 people from Assad.
And in Syria.
In Syria. Yeah. And it's like, well, where were you? If you care about these people in this area, and you don't like seeing death, is it just because you're seeing it? Is it because you didn't see the children in Syria every single day on, you know, in social media? Is that the only reason?
It's not
why?
That they didn't see. They chose not to see. The videos were there. The pictures were there. They chose not to see it. And now they're.
And I have yet to hear one person respond to that and say, here is why this is different. Well, some people have said it's because of the money that America gives Israel. But America gives money to a lot of countries.
So what? There are people we will not change their minds, no matter what. But there are many people, what you said, are uninformed or afraid, but very uninformed. What movie, book, recommendation, play would you, about Israel, about Jewish life, about Jewish civil rights, what would you recommend that they see or read?
There's a film that came out last year called Irina's Vow.
Say that again?
Irina? Hold, please. Okay. They're going to be like, how did she, all of a sudden she had, Irina's Vow and the documentary from 2020, Viral, Anti-Semitism in Four Mutations by Andrew Goldberg.
Uh-huh.
But Irina's Vow is a true story about a Christian Pole, a young woman who saved 12 Jews, and she ended up imprisoned for complicity, and then...
When was this?
This 1939 is when the story begins, and then she had saved this woman's Jewish husband, and that woman was imprisoned as well because she was Polish, and she orchestrated the escape of Irina out of prison because Irina had saved her husband. And they gave her a passport and they made her Jewish. And there's so many things that are amazing about this story. It shows that there is a choice for every human being to take action. Every single one of us. You don't have to be a professional activist. You don't have to know anything about it. You just have to look at people who are in need and decide, do I want to try and help them or not?
Wow. So what's next for you, for the fight?
Well, I've been going around the country speaking at Holocaust museums. And that has been actually very healing for me to be in community with so many Jews who are going through the same thing. We are in the editing process of Primal Fear, which is the documentary that explores anti-Semitism since October 7th, what's happened on college campuses.
And that's directed by Wendy Sachs.
Yes. Right. Besides that, I don't have a plan. If you had asked me 2 years ago, where were you going to be in 2 years, you know, it's like what you said, you don't know where you're going, what in 30 years, you don't know. My life has taken so many turns, and every time I think that I know what's happening next, I'm proven wrong. Mm. So I've stopped trying to guess or plan and just be open to where I'm needed. And I am just praying to have the strength and the courage and the endurance and the fortitude to continue to defend Israel in the face of most destructive propaganda.
Yeah. And you're learning Hebrew.
I am learning Hebrew. That came out of my trip to Israel. I was there and I was like, I was bat mitzvahed. I can read Hebrew. I just don't know what I'm saying. And I was like,
hey, to be fair, there are a lot of people who can read English and have no idea what they're saying in the United States. So,
yes, touche.
Yeah.
And so I started learning it. And
do you have a favorite Hebrew word or phrase
that
you're learning?
Ani rotza yain.
Which translates to I want wine. My mother-in-law, Kilat Ankori, will appreciate that. So. Okay, so
can I ask you a question?
Yes, of course.
Do you see a viable place for you at Columbia going forward?
I believe that there is a need for me mm-hmm. at Columbia. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that there is a desire from Columbia to have me there. I think many of my colleagues, including the ones that agree with what I'm saying, maybe they don't like how I'm doing it, they would rather me just go away. Because Columbia has lost a lot of money, a lot of donations, a lot of applications, and I think for good reason.
Yeah.
And instead of blaming Columbia, many of my colleagues, both to my face and behind my back, have blamed me. And there's a...
That's outrageous.
There's a sentence in the movie Amelie mm-hmm. That I've always loved that says, when the finger points at the sky, the idiots look at the finger.
Oh.
I've been pointing at a problem. I've been shouting about the problem. And I've been doing it in style that's abrasive to some people. And I completely understand it. But the reaction of donors, of students... applicants pulling out of the media rushing to cover Columbia is not because of me, it's because of what I'm pointing at. And a lot of my colleagues would rather just not have that attention and would rather me just disappear. And of course, some of them are bona fide Jew haters.
Are you expecting to be fired?
Just like you, I don't know. I don't expect anything. You know, when you were saying about 2 years ago, who would have thought that I'd be here? I have a childhood friend on one of our WhatsApp groups said, I'd never thought I would see the day that Shai will be wearing a huge Magen David. And I said, I'd never thought to see the day of October 7th.
Yeah. I never wore.
Things change.
I never wore one.
Things change. People change. If we stop changing, that's when things get bad.
Yeah.
So I finish every episode with what I'd be calling a Jewish lightning round.
Okay, go ahead.
A series of questions. There's no wrong answers. There's no right answers. Just whatever comes to mind. I tell people that you get one pass, but because you're Deborah Messing, you get as many passes as you want. But let's go. What is one thing people don't know about you?
That I can juggle.
I kind of want to ask if we have juggling balls here. All right.
When I got my master's degree at NYU, we had circus class. And that was part of it. And I actually was better at the trapeze than at juggling.
I love that. Now people do. What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
That we're relentless.
What is your favorite curse?
Fuck.
But can you say it like you mean it?
I also love motherfucker. Motherfucker is really good. Or cocksucker. That's a good one.
When was the last time you cried?
This morning.
If you could have any person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
Hillel Neuer.
Same way.
But, you know...
Hillel Neuer is from...
From UN the Watch. UN Watch. And it's like David and Goliath. To me, he's a hero. And he goes around the world, and he has been fighting the systemic anti-Semitism and anti-Israel sentiment and witch hunt in the UN for over 10 years. And he has not given up, and his passion has not waned, and he is respectful every time he speaks. To me, he is a model of what a beautiful, effective, powerful activist looks like.
I kind of want to have now an episode where we have a Shabbat dinner with you and Hillel Neuer.
I would love it.
So, Achi, let's put that in the works. What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
Passover.
What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
I know I'm not supposed to say Yom Kippur, but...
Almost everyone has been saying Yom Kippur. For something about the food. When do you feel safest?
Oh, wow, that's a really good question. When I'm home.
When do you feel least safe?
Now, on the streets of New York.
That's quite an admonition, right? That's...
Never in my wildest dreams would I have ever imagined I would have said that.
Let's hope it changes. What gives you hope?
You. Oh.
Pass. Finally, every episode I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
The Anti-Defamation League. I think that if your focus is on fighting anti-Semitism, that is a well-established charity. I also really love Stand With Us. Mm-hmm. It's an organization that I've come to know recently. And there are so many, though.
Yeah.
There are so many.
There's so many. I call it the matzah ball alphabet soup of Jewish charities.
Yeah. As long as you give, long, you know, tzedakah.
As long as you give, that's all we ask. Give, act, do something.
Amen.
Where can people find you?
In my apartment.
you said you feel safest at home. I don't think you want people to find you in your apartment.
You know, on my Instagram, The Real Deborah Messing, I used to be very active on Twitter, and I have since abandoned it. For my mental health.
Yes.
So really, that's the place.
Funny you would say that. I started an Instagram account to get away from Twitter. So now I go to Twitter to fight, and I go to Instagram to love.
I love that.
We talked a lot about how things changed dramatically for you and for me, and obviously for many of us since October 7th. Never in my wildest dreams did I ever imagine that I would be saying this sentence. So here I am with Deborah Messing. Thank you so much for everything that you do and for taking the time. And I feel like I could talk for hours, and I probably will. Maybe we'll have you and Wendy when the movie comes out.
Yeah. We'll come over, we'll bring some yain.
I love that. Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at the Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."